The time has come to start. Once again, I'm Marge Wold, and under the general theme of A View from the Water's Edge, we're talking this week about change. We've talked about personal change, interpersonal change, and now we're going to talk about community and congregational change. By the way, some of you were asking about our books, and there weren't any in the bookstore that we had authored, co-authored, but they discovered a box full of books in the corner that had never been opened, so apparently there are books there now. Okay, as I mentioned before, the work I have been doing for the last 4.5 years is as a staff person for the American Lutheran Church Division for Service Mission in America. And at the time I was called, a new job description was written in response to some specific needs that probably were exacerbated in the South Pacific district of our church. And that district includes 6 states, California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, El Paso, little piece of Texas we got, and Hawaii. And we found at least 80 congregations that were being impacted by change in their communities, and impacted to the powers that be in the church meant adversely impacted. You know, they were suffering economically, statistically, in all the ways that matter to the general secretary of the church. So I was called with the job mandate that I was to do something about this situation. Well, lo and behold, I discovered that nobody else in the Lutheran church had ever had this kind of a job, so there was nobody I could go to and say, what do I do now? And I have spent a lot of time learning what the needs of those churches are, understanding the psychological and emotional dynamics, and trying to resource them. Some beautiful things that have happened as a result. I certainly have learned a lot. We have a long way to go. I alternate between hope and despair constantly. You ask me one day, you know, how's it going? I'd say, just great, we're really making great strides. And then the next day I might say nothing's happening at all. In fact, it's worse. So you don't know how to measure or evaluate the results of this kind of work. But change is a constant. We know that that's one of the few things we can be sure of, that every day is a new day. Every day I'm going to be a day older, and something is going to be different in my life, in the community. So change is something we all need to be aware of and to understand. So one could describe the situation from many different perspectives, sociologically, psychologically, ecclesiologically, politically. My perspective probably is missiologically. I'm concerned about the mission of the church in changing communities. And that involves a lot of understandings of the other perspectives. Sociologically, well, perhaps the maps that I have up here can best illustrate what caused my job to be created. In 1977, the County of Los Angeles produced a set of maps to illustrate the changes that were taking place mainly ethnically in Los Angeles County. And this map is based on, the colorations are based on the census tracts from 1970, those divisions. And they represent the dominant culture in that census tract. So it doesn't mean that a census tract that's pink is all white people. There might be people who speak Spanish or Asian or black, but the predominant group is the white culture, or the pinks, if you want to call it that. And you can see how the county of Los Angeles cutely put this in by having all the Anglos or whites or Caucasians, depending upon what the opposite is, pictured with the color pink. And you can see that that's most of Los Angeles County. And then the Hispanics, pictured here in this kind of light tan, brown people. And the dark gray, the black population. The gray areas are statistically irrelevant because they represent airports, places where people don't live. And then the white areas represent those that are in transition. There's no one group that dominates. This was in 1950. And this is the way Los Angeles County could be represented ethnically in 1950, or culturally was a better term. Most of the congregations, Lutheran congregations, and probably most of the major denominations, established congregations in the Southwest in the 1950s, after World War II. Before that, I suppose that the combined American Lutheran and Evangelical Lutheran churches had possibly 100 congregations. And suddenly, with the migration of young families from the Midwest, the church followed them to this area and established congregations, which is very important for us to remember, that when we have talked about American missions in the past, we have not really talked about missions. We've talked about following people who already are Lutherans around the country, identifying them and getting together a significant number of families who are willing to be the nucleus of a new congregation. And then the pastor who is called has to go around finding out how many Lutherans there are in the community and using them to build a congregation. And if you can get enough to make a viable community, that is church community, usually that ends mission for the church, and that's where it stays, except for the few people that later on come in by transfer or by friends bringing friends. So this is 1950. There were a series of four maps, but I'm just using the last two. This is the change in the 1980 picture. The only thing wrong with this map, this was projected in 1977, is that it isn't, it doesn't show as much change as it ought to, because it didn't reckon with a lot of the current Asian immigration. I should have pointed out to you that the only yellow spot on that other map I showed you was one little tiny yellow dot almost invisible to you. That was Chinatown. And that was the Asian, predominantly Asian community. Now you can see what changes have taken place. As I say, this is grossly underestimated, the Hispanic population of Los Angeles County. Hispanics are everywhere, and many more communities would have as the predominant group people who speak mainly Spanish. As perhaps some of you know, most public signs and all ballots now in California have to be printed in English and Spanish, which again is kind of our Anglo assumption that that makes it all okay, because many people, though they speak Spanish, don't read it. But you can see the increase of black population in what is called the Harbor Corridor, because it runs along the Harbor Freeway south from downtown toward Long Beach. The black population of Los Angeles has pretty much stabilized and may even be decreasing as people are migrating again back to their roots in other parts of the country. But pretty much stabilized. The Hispanic population is increasing enormously, and the Asian population, as the Hispanic, is grossly underrepresented. The Olympic Boulevard in Los Angeles, the Olympic Corridor, is now almost all Korean, has a giant Korean community center there. Koreans are moving toward Orange County, down this way along Highway 5 toward San Diego. And in Orange County, the estimate has been 50,000 Koreans. Garden Grove Boulevard, where we live, has mainly Korean signs now. And in fact, we will be calling a Korean Lutheran pastor to our congregation to start a Korean ministry. But these changes have profoundly affected congregations. Where do Lutherans come from in the United States? Well, we all know they're Northern European by background. And we never have become an indigenous American Lutheran church. I guess we don't really know, do we, what is American culture? And so we have pretty much kept to our own ethnic backgrounds as far as European roots are concerned. We still sing German hymns, Norwegian hymns, Swedish hymns. In fact, we think we're being multicultural if we introduce a Finnish hymn or a Polish hymn, you know, much less anything that has come out of black culture or the Spanish language culture. So there is, when we talk about change and the Lutheran Church, it's something that none of us know how to tackle. Along with ethnic or cultural change, the situation has been also compounded by the declining birth rate. Congregations are in areas, most of our congregations are in areas affected by the declining birth rate and the movement of young families out of the city into the suburban areas, where for a while anyway, the property costs were cheaper. That's changed a lot now because also we're reckoning with inflation. The changing role of women has affected the churches. More women are working. When we came to Orange County in January of 1971, we figured that 20% of the women in our congregation were employed outside the home, that is, of married women. Now 65% are employed outside the home. 2 years ago, our ALCW disbanded, and because of a lack of interest and a lack of leadership, and strangely enough, we really haven't felt too much the lack of it, because there's too much else going on in the church, and women, the changing role also has meant that women now are active in all areas of our congregational life, so that they'll represent maybe 50% of church council seats and that kind of involvement. But ecclesiologically, our church still insists that congregations have to grow numerically and that a test of ministry is whether or not you add to your numbers every year and increase your benevolence. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but it just affects the life of the congregation as it seeks to bring in people who can provide financial support for the congregation. It also affects our understanding of mission because we will hear people who have to do with American missions saying it makes sense to go and establish congregations where they can become self-supporting fast. So that our view of mission depends on how the church feels about that data. We see political changes from the 50s and the 60s, where there wasn't the reaction against poverty and the immigrant population, because in the 50s, one-third of the immigrants to this country came from Europe. How many of your congregations were active in resettling German refugees? And our church had a whole program of resettlement where we had people over in Germany trying to help people who had come from, say, the Balkan states and all, get into this country and sponsor them. Now, one-third of the immigrants to our country are coming from Asia. And the numbers have just reversed. There is no more a flow of Northern European immigrants to the United States. Politically also, we're seeing a change in attitude toward poor people. And in the cities, when you're talking about urban areas, you're talking about minority people who have never been given the same opportunities in our country. And you can argue that if you want to, but I think Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker summarizes very much an attitude that seems to me to be coming to the fore again when she says in her book, The Long Loneliness, "From my earliest remembrance, the destitute were always looked upon as the shiftless, the worthless, those without talent of any kind, let alone the ability to make a living for themselves. They were that way because of their own fault. They chose their lot. They drank. They were the prodigal sons who were eating the swine's husks only because they had squandered their inheritance. They were to seek for pie in the sky. Weren't to have anything here." And we see a rise of that. In our area of the country, the Ku Klux Klan is on the rise, vigorously, aggressively. Posters will be posted on telephone posts, "Join the Ku Klux Klan," and give all the reasons why. It's to the self-interest of people to join the Klan. We see a rise in racism that really concerns the people of God. And we have some lay people who feel called prophetically to engage in the struggle against the Klan. We see that the name of God probably is now not being spelled G-O-D, but G-N-P. And it's our gross national product that becomes our God. So that what's happening in Los Angeles is that with the flight of white people out of the city into the suburbs, that they are taking with them their financial institutions, their banks, their industries, their factories. In the last 3 years, we have had 12 major plants close in the Los Angeles area, where mainly the poor, the blue-collar workers, the people who have manual skills live. We've had the closing of Goodyear. Institutions, factories that have been there for 25, 30 years are now closing. Goodyear, Goodrich, Firestone, Uniroyal, all the tire factories, and Los Angeles is the world's best market for tires, have moved out of there and gone to foreign markets to look for cheap labor markets. We've had the closing of General Motors, Ford, American Bridge and Steel, and now we're threatened with the closing of Kaiser Steel in Fontana, a community which was built up to serve Kaiser Steel. That's happening. Job unemployment in the Los Angeles area, due to these factors, runs as high as 60% among young black males. Females can usually find work because they're in demand as servants in the homes of wealthy people who surround their areas. So all of this contributes to a change in the congregations that are in the areas of the Southwest. I just used Los Angeles as probably the most outstanding example, and because that's where most of our churches are. That's where the mass of people were emigrating in the 50s, 40s, and 50s. 1,000 people a day moved into the San Fernando Valley, which is an area that you saw in the county up north of Los Angeles. So 30,000 a month. Well, what does this mean then for our congregation? So I'm going to pass this out and we can look at this. Now, when it comes to ministry and mission, we have no idea at all how to do it in a multicultural society. No idea at all. I just get very distressed when I listen to seminarians and seminary faculty talking about, oh, over here now they have a professor who's going to tell them how to do Hispanic ministry. And they have another professor who's going to tell them how to do Black ministry. Another professor is going to show them how to do Asian ministry. And we don't have any of those nice, discreet neighborhoods around. Where we live, even in Orange County, which is one of the original white flight areas, our neighbors to the left are Japanese Mormons. Our neighbors across the street are Russian Muslims. Our neighbor to the right is a white Southern Baptist. Across the street there is a woman who was born in Grand Forks, North Dakota, but has lived out there since childhood, and they don't go to church anywhere, and they resist going to church anywhere. And so it goes. And then across the street over there are Spanish-speaking people, and around the corner. So we have neighborhoods that you can't say, this is, you got to do Asian ministries here. You got to do Hispanic. We don't have those neat little divisions. You know, there aren't those little ghettos and barrios that we whites like to think exist, but only exist in our own imagination. We have neighborhoods, yes. We have neighborhoods where people who are like each other congregate, but not enough so that we can say this is a place where we're going to do this kind of ministry. You may have to make a decision where the plurality is that yes, you will make an emphasis in that direction, but we really don't know how to do a true cross-cultural evangelism and mission and ministry in the United States. We've worked it out for world mission fields, but not in the United States. Now, I gave you this. And who would like to read this for the sake of the people who are going to be listening to the tape so they can hear another voice besides my cracked, hoarse voice? Anybody? Okay.
Pastor Gary looked out the windows of his study. The grade school across the street from First Church was noisily dismissing its laughing, pushing, poking, and energetic student body. How many times had he watched them, studying them, wondering about them, praying for them? They were a microcosm of the nations of the world, Filipino, Black, Anglo, Hispanic, Japanese. He knew many of them by name, and they knew him as Pastor Gary. Wearily, he turned away, drawing the grapes to shut out the familiar scene and turning to the proposal on his desk. The church council had met last night and decided to present to the congregation their case for a brick wall fence all around the church property. He had seen it coming ever since the school had built its 10-foot high chain link fence and closed off the playground and basketball court. A week ago, there was a broken window, and recently more graffiti on the 76-year-old building. Pastor Gary had begun to arrange his schedule in such a way that he made his other calls earlier in the day so that he could be with the schoolchildren in the afternoon. He had enlisted some of the young people from the church and the local high school to help him with organized activities after school. Pastor Gary knew that many of his parishioners would vote for the council proposal, especially if to vote for by secret ballot. Lying next to the proposal on his desk was a letter of call which had come 3 days ago from a 12-year-old congregation in a new area on the other side of the city. So, now if I use the pastor, I really would be running away, exactly. I've been here 5 years now. Maybe my time is up and someone else can relate better to this congregation. And at 45, I can't pass up too many calls. But, and a sharp pang of longing grabbed at him, I'm just beginning to get to know the people of this neighborhood, beginning to feel at home with them. They like me too, I know it. And the older people in the church, they're beginning to trust me too. They know I love them. It's just those few people who don't want their building used for anything but worship. Is it worth the effort to confront them and maybe lose anyway and then be forced to resign? Pastor Gary sighed. He could hear the children on the church playground now. What about them and their future? What about the future of this church without them? And what about him? Was his future linked with theirs?
Okay. This is not any one church, but it would be an accurate description of many churches with slight variations. And we're not going to spend a lot of time discussing here, but I'm going to leave these with you and hope that you will talk about them maybe in groups or together. What dynamics are at work in First Church? What are the dynamics of the struggle in Pastor Gary? How would you vote on the council's proposal if you were a member of First Church? What counsel would you give to Pastor Gary if he asked you to discuss his predicament with him? Well, enter the consultant, Marge Wold. This is when I get called in. And you know the definition, what a consultant does, somebody who blows in, blows off, and blows out. And that maybe is often the case. But what I have learned as I've dealt with congregations, and I found that while we originally identified 80, I have worked probably with 125. There were many, many more. And I've worked intersynodically. The LCA has called me in. Even LCMS has called me in. I meet with their district Hispanic committee and Episcopalian, yes. So everybody is in the same predicament. How do we deal with change when we're working with groups of people? Well, one thing I've become aware of, in every such situation, you have to deal with two groups. What I call, and what has been identified by others, as the remnant and the new situation, whatever that is, whether it's singles or a new ethnic, racial group, or whether it's apartment ministries, you always have to deal with the people who have a vested interest in the congregation, who've probably been there a long time, have put a lot of their own energies, their own financial resources in the congregation, and for whom it has become a support group. Most of these people are old, and I mean older than, say, the median age of our society, which is like 30 now. People who are retired, mostly, and people who have belonged to the congregation for quite a while, people who probably still are looked upon as the undesignated leaders of the congregation, whether they hold office or not. They're the people that Lyle Schaller refers to as the pioneers, and the war is between the pioneers and the settlers. And it's still the old cowboy theme that you see in the Range War movies. The settlers come in and want to change grazing habits and all that sort of thing. So to deal then, it takes an unusual kind of person in the terms of leadership, pastoral leadership, a person who can affirm the needs of the remnant group, and those people often have a high need for pastoral care. They have illnesses, many of them are shut in, many of them are hospitalized, and they want the pastor to visit them, They feel they deserve the pastor's time. But the congregation cannot afford more than one pastor, and often they can't afford one full-time pastor. And how many pastors have both the gifts to work with this group and the energy and the gifts to get out in the community and find out what's happening out there and to do whatever he or she can missiologically in the community? And that's part of the predicament. We don't have people trained for that. We still think in terms of doing ministry in a way that was very comfortable in the Midwest. And we are still training. We only have one Lutheran seminary, accredited Lutheran seminary, west of the Mississippi Valley. And that's Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley. All of our other Lutheran seminaries are all east of the Mississippi Valley. That means how much of the country is left, in a sense, without the kind of representation of for these kinds of communities, without really somebody assessing those kinds of needs. Even if, say, in Ohio, you have a situation where there's an attempt to work with black-white communities, you don't have the pluralism represented. Maybe the eastern states come closest to the kind of pluralism we're talking about in the West. But even their pluralism is an older, more established kind. This is all new, the changes now in the Southwest. So the first thing we learned, and we mentioned that the other night, is that when you have change, you always have resistance. I wish I had learned that earlier in my life, that whenever you're going to make changes, you will have resistance. Even if you think the people want the change, they still resist it. Because there's security with the known, and there's insecurity out there where you've never been before. How do you know what it's going to be like? You fear the shape of the future if you lose control. And so the remnant fights very hard to maintain control. They put down many conditions for change. If you start a new ministry that's going to reach out to Spanish-speaking people, okay, they can only use the basement, you know, or they can only use the fellowship hall, but they can never worship in the sanctuary. And certainly never, even if they grow faster, and especially if they grow faster than the remnant, which is decreasing, and the new ministry is increasing. Now, for instance, in one congregation, we have 60 people coming to church of Danish extraction. They have a Hispanic ministry, and there they have 140 coming to church in 3 years. And the Danish church has been there for 75 years. Still, they will not give up the sanctuary at 11 o'clock. You see, the larger growing group has to squeeze into less attractive worship quarters, and the small diminishing group has to keep the sanctuary. So restrictions are laid down by the pioneers on what the settlers can do and can't do. And the need to keep control is very, very strong. Now, we can understand that and say we know where it's coming from, but how to deal with it? And it takes a wizard, you know, somebody who understands the whole psychodynamics and all of the factors that go into change. How many of our pastors have been trained to deal with group dynamics and to understand that? They have been trained to deal with people who want somebody to lead them in worship in a building that has a pulpit and an altar, from which the pastor who has had homiletics is going to preach, and who has been trained in liturgy is going to sing. You know, what do you do to get out into the community and find out if there are other ways of gathering the people of God and of doing word and sacrament ministries? If they don't have a sanctuary, if the sanctuary isn't available, and those are some of the factors. Okay, with resistance, as change comes, there is a grief process. And I think that's very important for all of us to understand. Whenever you make changes, what was part of the resistance to the Green Book when you change from the Red Book? Not only familiarity, you know, but grief. When you lost the Red Book, you lost part of your past. You had to start something new. And there's always grief. And grief includes denial. Who needs the Green Book? You know, we don't need that. Nothing's going on. No, the community has not changed. What I do with congregations often is after church on Sunday, when I'm invited in, and we start, usually I'm given the opportunity to preach on Sunday mornings, then after church I take whoever wants to stay on what we call a walk-around activity. And I give them a piece of paper and they're to listen for other languages. How many languages did you hear? How many people of other ethnic groups did you hear, see? And what ages were represented? We go to a shopping area and listen and walk around and assess. Because often, you see, what happens is these people are driving in up to 20 miles to that congregation. They don't live there anymore around there in the neighborhood. Some of them do, the very old, and usually the poor who can't afford to move. But they drive in, and they maintain control of the church council and of the offices, but they don't even know what's happening in that neighborhood. So that somebody who drives into Los Angeles from the San Fernando Valley and whose children go to school in Encino, for instance, is obviously going to be concerned about the local schools, the local property values, the local housing, and doesn't care a thing about what's happening to the neighborhood around the church building. So I get them to walk around and look and listen, and sometimes that's like a great big light going off in their head. They never knew that there actually were new people in the area. So the only way you can deal with denial is to keep repeating the data. Just keep on repeating it and forcibly show. But if people want to deny, people are so threatened by change that they want to stay in denial, there's nothing you can do. And I just leave when I see that that's... So part of my job is to assess where in the continuum of grief this group of people is. And it's just like somebody who is told they have cancer. They always go, we know, Kubler-Ross talks about that, go through the stage of denial. Not me. You go through that on your 30th, 40th, and 50th birthdays. You know, you wake up in the morning, Lord, not me, I can't be 50. You know, and then you go to the next stage, anger, why me? And often I come into congregations where the congregation is in this stage. They know that the data is correct. The neighborhood has changed. But they're angry about it. And in this stage, you have a lot of scapegoating. This is usually where they want to get rid of the pastor. Because they usually think that it's the pastor's fault, and if they could only get the pastor back that they had in the 1950s, that would make everything okay. Problem with this pastor today is he can't preach, he doesn't care about people, he's too liberal, anything. Or they fight each other. And certainly they blame the new people in the community, because that's why they don't have all these nice little white kids around anymore. Is because the neighborhood's gotten so rough and run down, and it's so violent. So a lot of scapegoating. If I come into a congregation when they're angry, they usually transfer the anger to me, which is okay. That's a function of a consultant, and I can bear away the anger, and it can go with me, and often then they stop fighting with each other, or it drains off some of the hostility. But during this stage, the important thing is to listen. Just listen. Because, you know, what can you do about it? Feelings are there. It's no use denying the feelings. So do a lot of listening. Then the next stage would be bargaining. And at this stage, if I come in, I found out that most congregations, the magic figure for curing all their ills is $35,000. I don't know why $35,000, but they always say if the DSMA or the DMNA, whatever, would just give them $35,000, their situation, they could do it. They could make the change. Well, it's not a bad stage. It's kind of a creative stage, because if they can come up with a good idea for ministry in that community, I can usually find them the $35 or whatever it takes, $1,000. But we don't do things like paint the building and put on a new roof, unless they can come up with a ministry program that says this congregation is here to do ministry and to deal with the community in a theologically sound way. But if they come up with something like a day nursery, we've found that day nurseries are excellent ways of reaching out to the community for congregations that have not done anything before to reach out. It helps the people of the neighborhood, shows that the congregation cares, is willing to use their property for programs that help the community. So we can find them the money. And we have congregations in California who are in wealthier, especially white flight areas, who for one reason or another are willing to give money to help congregations. And I'm not at all averse to taking money wherever it is, whether it's guilt money or what. So we get it. But this is kind of creative stage. But also then there's depression. When you see that all of this is going to cause something drastically different to happen, and it really is never going to be like it was in the 50s. You're never again going to have that parish hall filled with kids in Sunday school. Never again is the Women's Society going to be as it used to be, because all that's left of that group is a one circle now. There is a lot of depression, because for many people that is a death of their past, and to hold out hope. Finally, they come to the point of acceptance. Now, the problem with acceptance, it usually comes too late to do anything about it. Congregations don't want to change until they're in crisis. I wish I could get at some congregations now that are still doing well but are starting to decline. And usually one of the things I do when I come into to a congregation, if I do get a chance to come into those, I have them identify with me where they are on what someone has identified, as kind of the life continuum, the bell curve, also applies to organizational life. And congregations are also organizations. They start out and with a vision of some kind, and the energy sweeps up, and the people there are enthusiastic, and they go out and enlist other people. They say, come and see, something's happening here. And they build programs, and they get going. And then about at 25 to 30 years, somewhere in there, congregations plateau out. And then they start becoming conservative. And by conservative, I mean they look backwards and try to conserve the best of what was in their past rather than looking forward. Because they say, if we could only do better and try harder to do the things that we used to do, we could get back that past. But usually that does not. Try harder is kind of a futile effort if it means looking backwards. They start declining. And when they start declining and they just try harder and all that and try to keep the remnant going,
the decline is inevitable. Now, when I get them often, you know, they're about down here. If I can get them here and ask them then to start looking at what's the vision for today and really get new energies mobilized and start that upward energy curve again, it would be great. But nobody wants to face what's really happening until they're in crisis. And then when they're in crisis, what we have to deal with mostly is conflict. And a lot of the energies go in dealing with the scapegoating of pastors, the wanting to get rid of pastors, the divisions in the congregation, the kind of thing you read in the case study. Do we put up a fence or don't we? And it splits the congregation in two. And this is not just a made-up story. I was called to one of our cities in the mid part of California, and a congregation there in a changing neighborhood. And I drove up to the church, and I just felt my heart sink, because they're in a neighborhood that had a lot of single family homes, single parent homes, a lot of little children, a lot of teenagers, of mixed racial groups, white, black, Filipino. The church had a 6-foot high chain link fence and 3 rows of barbed wire around it. You know, I sat there and I could feel tears coming, because they were calling me to find out how to help their congregation grow. And they had shut out the mission field. But this happens all the time. If the neighborhood, say if you're talking about racial or ethnic change, if the neighborhood has 10% new ethnic group, that's called pre-transitional, 10 to 30%. If it gets up to 30, 45%, that's already transitional. But if you get beyond 45%, that's post-transitional, and you can rarely do anything about it. The church is identified as a white church, and I worked with our church in Compton, which has been an all-black church for at least 10 or 11 years. And when I did a retreat with those people, and I asked them, what's keeping your church from growing? One of the ladies, after a moment of thoughtful silence, said, I think people in the neighborhood still think of our church as a white folks' church. And I think she was right. The identity of that congregation had stayed white so long that there was no way the people in the neighborhood could think of it in terms of their own needs. So we had to work hard then to do some things to get the identity of that congregation changed. Well, what are some of the solutions that are being suggested by the church at large? Probably one of the most common ones today, most prominent ones, is the church growth movement. And that just brings the same kind of dread to my spirit. The church growth movement is an outgrowth of the School of Missions at Fuller Seminary, but comes out of the World Mission Movement with Donald McGavran, who was a missionary in India, went to England first, and then with Win Arn, came to this country. And its prophet today is Peter Wagner, who has published books like, how many 10 Steps to Church Growth or Your Church Can Grow. How many of you have read those? Okay. You know, it finds fertile ground in society today, because it says the best way for your church to grow is to have to understand the sociological principle that birds of a feather flock together. So therefore, don't ever try to do multicultural ministry. Like wants like.
So only go after, if you're a white church, white people. Now, if you're in a neighborhood, what does that mean if you're in a multicultural neighborhood? It means if you want your church to grow white, you sell out, board it up, and you move to where white people are. And this has happened. I was with one of our Lutheran churches in Oakland that is now in its fourth location. It has moved to avoid the black population 4 times. Now it sits up on the top of a hill in Oakland, and all of the area around it is black. And there it is. But it's starting to change. But you see, it had to be forced to change. And that's what I mean when I say resistance to change is a given in any change situation. Now they, for one thing, there aren't enough people there to move anywhere. And they have a pastor who I think is going to do that. A day nursery is part of the program that brings young black families and their relatives into the congregation. The danger with the church growth movement is it works. Robert Schuller is the prime example. Robert Schuller could only have made it in Orange County in the white flight days. And then, of course, he was smart enough to start a national television program to rescue the church when it came to its plateau. 25 years it has plateaued out with 9,000 members. And no more growth. The area is not growing right there in Orange County. But he's got national television to support the local congregation. They'd never make it with the Crystal Cathedral, with just the people who are there. But the problem is not that, you know, it's successful, but it's successful on the basis of really what is a heresy. There is nothing wrong with theology of glory in the sense that Christ is glorified, we have the victory, and as you know, our Bible study leader pointed out this morning, that's part of the whole good news. But it emphasizes one aspect of the gospel over against so much of the fullness, the wholeness. Like there's nothing wrong with a healing ministry. But if it's just a healing ministry and doesn't deal with all the other teaching and the fullness of ministry, or dealing with the social, the other physical needs of people, their needs for food and clothing, then it's just one aspect. So the problem is then with the church growth movement is that it dooms the city to hopelessness. It just says, get up and move out. And that's the way to make it. So it dooms the city, and that's my concern. I took this from the library because I want to show there is a good article on the church growth movement in this current issue of the Christian Century, and a good analysis. And I recommend it to you for reading. I'll put it back on the table. It has nothing to do with the suffering servant concept or the people of God as the servants of society. So what do I do when I go in? What are some of the bases on which I do my work? I had to fight with the whole church growth movement in myself, and I have heard Peter Wagner. I know what they teach. I've been to the church leadership school at Schuller's church because I want to give them a fair chance. I learned a lot of things from Schuller about congregational life and organization. But I had to find peace theologically myself with what I am doing. Early on, when I was attacked that the way to do mission was just to close the churches that were in pluralistic neighborhoods and move out where we could be assured of some success financially and in numbers, I came across the Revelation passage in 7:9 where it says, I beheld a great host, or which no one could number, of people of all races, nations, climates, tongues, all standing before the throne praising God and saying, worthy is our God. And I just felt then that what the kind of work I was doing was to prepare people for the interracial neighborhood in heaven, and that there we're going to all be together. So I found peace with that, and now my concern, and one of the things I try to teach congregations as I move in, is what I believe is the way to do ministry, if we are to follow the example of Jesus Christ, is to do an incarnational style of ministry. And that means starting with identifying your parish. Now that sounds ridiculous. But since as people moved away from the church and started moving out here, that we've got the concept that the parish were the people who come to worship on Sunday mornings. So I tried to get them to think in terms of a geographical parish in the city. That this is our area of responsibility. This is our turf, to use the term common in our area. This is their turf. Now that helps, because if you're thinking about a whole city and multicultural and all, it's too big and people can't handle it. But you say, we can handle an area that's 1 mile square or half a mile square or 2 blocks square. I don't care how they identify it, but just so they identify an area and then say, who is here? What is here? What resources are here? What are the needs here? And then say, what can we do to meet those needs in ministry? Then we start identifying them. We do the community analysis. We get up. One of the things that I would like to get rid of, that I hope seminaries are no longer teaching, is the concept of an enabler. When I hear a pastor say to me, I'm an enabler, you know, I know he's never going to make it, or she's never going to make it. Because who do you enable when all you've got left are 50 people over 70 to go out and do mission and ministry? And I find that very few pastors anymore want to get out and find out who's in their turf and say to the people in that area, knock on their door and say, I am the pastor of this church on the corner of so-and-so, and if you ever have needs for pastoral care, call on me. I don't find that happening anymore, and yet that's the only successful model I've come across. We have a church that's really making it as a biracial church in Inglewood, California, an old Danish church. Wasn't there for 75 years. It had to move because a freeway took their other building. But they've been there for a long time, very Danish. And they got a Danish pastor, Anker Jensen. Now, you can't get much more Danish. And Anker Jensen looked like an Anker Jensen. He was small, precise, always wore a suit, tie. But Anker Jensen had an old-fashioned notion that he was supposed to claim the people in the neighborhood. And the people in that neighborhood were, at that time, probably 75% black people. And he went out and he knocked and he invited all of them. My name is Anker Jensen. You know, and if you ever have needs for pastoral care, call me. Give him his card. And not come to our program, come to church, but call me. You're in my parish, my turf. Got one black woman who became one of his deacons and taught him how to minister. She gave him his postgraduate course. Now, it wasn't easy, and he had to meet a lot of the resistance, but Anker Jensen simply said to people, this is what I'm called to do. The Lord has called me to claim all people regardless of their race, their economic background, whatever. That church is probably now 60% black, 40% white, and the new people coming in the new class are both black and white, and everybody loves it. And one thing that I hold out is hope that when churches turn the corner in transition and become multicultural, there is, at least for a while, a period of great joy. Because people seem to say, this is what the kingdom of God is all about. And I hate to go back to Minneapolis for meetings because I go around and everybody in the streets look alike to me. They all look the same. And in Los Angeles, you know, when I walk down the street, I see people from all over the world.
March, we went to Norway once, and they all look like our neighbors in Minneapolis.
Yeah. Right. Well, you get so used to that, and you have great joy in the sense that you're part of a world community. So the people in congregations, and a lady that I've known for many years, who is now around 86 or 7, and is in that congregation, she said to me, I hope we never go back to what we were. And I think that's the hope. If we can get beyond our resistance, beyond our fear, and find out that we all have the same hopes and aspirations. People that I've met of all cultures want their children to be healthy. They want their children to achieve. They want daily bread. They want to live in peace and harmony. They don't want their children to be murdered. They want them to be taught in good schools. When we find out that we all want the same things, you know, we've crossed a big hurdle. And there is that joy. Well, I don't think we have time for any questions, but I hope that this is provocative of some discussion for you. And I was going to have us do some singing to show you how few really multicultural hymns there are in the hymn book. And I don't even know if any of you know that the Black National Anthem is in there. Do you know that? 562 is the Black National Anthem. You might look at that. And that's about the only one, except maybe Were You There When They Crucified My Lord, which we sang before. But some of the things we need, and I'll just quickly mention these, from my perspective, are new methods of recruiting, training, and supporting pastors. And I have been, one of my dreams is to start an urban missionary order, which may be outside the church structures. I don't know. But I'm working on it, and I have some cooperation from the head of our division, Jim Berquist. I think we need a constant needling of the power structures to let them know that we don't want our church to be just from what is happening in the world today, retreat into being just a Northern European Lutheran church. We want to be in mission and ministry here in this country as well as overseas. I think we need a new vigilance against racism and be aware of how it crops up in the subtlest forms. I hate ethnic jokes with a passion, almost as much as I hate sexist jokes. And I think we need a new understanding of worship as mission. That worship is, that's one thing I learned from Robert Schuller. Worship for Robert Schuller is recruiting the unchurched. Sunday nights is the family of God church service at Schuller's church. And he lets the unchurched know they're not welcome. Sunday night is for his people. That's where they have the sacrament. That's where they get their Bible study. That's where they get to be their family. But mission, worship as mission, as outreach. And I think when sometimes people come into our congregations and they hear us singing our liturgies, it's like speaking in tongues. And the Bible says if somebody comes into your worship and you're speaking in tongues, they don't understand what's going on. It's a jargon that's familiar to us who are Lutheran, but has no sense at all to the unchurched. And then I think to understand that change is here to stay. Guess where my latest invitation to deal with changing communities came from? Williston, North Dakota. Williston and Minot, North Dakota are changing communities, and they don't know how to deal with it. And there's at least 65% Lutheran. So change is here to stay. California is on the prophetic edge of change. And I hope that what we are learning there will help the whole church in the future. Thank you very much.